welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic. With me in the studio is a visitor to Fairbanks and to the university named John Massey Stewart, who's from London, England, and he is a writer and a journalist. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
We haven't had very much time to talk in advance, and so the audience, the radio audience, is going to get a chance to learn a little about you and your life at the same time that I learn it.
Hi. Okay.
You grew up in London? You were born in London?
No. I was born in Nottingham, actually. And if one's going to come talking about Russian things later on, as I'm sure we are, I might just say that my father was, this is where I got my first interest in Russia from, I suppose, although I don't remember him because he died when I was a very small boy. But he was in Russia before the revolution as a tutor to a wealthy family, and he stayed with them in St. Petersburg and went on the Trans-Siberian Railway, actually not as far as Siberia, but just this side, and set off across the wastes in a, I think it was a telyega, which is a rather primitive sort of, I might almost say chariot.
Chariot.
And stayed on them in their estates and went wolf hunting. And we've still got his diary, which has never been published, which is really quite interesting because there's a certain amount of social history of that time there. And when he came back, as far as I can understand, he was there for about 2 years. This is as a Cambridge undergraduate, firstly in his vacations and then afterwards. And then he came back and wrote a couple of books about it and went into the academic world, taking up classics. And although he turned his back on Russian things, he did actually do some translations of Chekhov and so on, although there was no interest in Britain at that time, and he never got them published. But I think I grew up with this sort of background, you know, running about in my mind.
Both knowledge and interest in Russia.
I don't know about knowledge, but interest.
That, actually, you anticipated another question. I was going to ask, prior to the revolution, were there, in fact, a lot of association between England and Russia?
Well, I'm interested you have asked that point, and maybe you have done more homework than you admit to having done. But I certainly got very heavily involved in the remarkable story of Britain's relations with Siberia, which go way back into the sort of 1560-odd. And that's an incredible story, because there were just so many associations between that time and 1985.
About to be 86.
That's right. And I discovered a great deal of travel literature, particularly of the late 19th century, when British people went over in astonishing numbers, as a matter of fact, much more than really go over now. And as a result of this, when there was an official British week in Novosibirsk, the largest city in Siberia, it's about 1.5 million, as far as I remember, I was asked to put on an exhibition of British-Siberian contacts over the past 4 centuries, and the Russian authorities in Moscow shrugged their shoulders and said, well, you know, what could there possibly be? But when the exhibition was put up there, and I went over to do a lecture with it, people were absolutely amazed at how much there was. You know, there were missionaries and teachers, and there was somebody who was teaching their pupil. He was a tutor on the Siberian Chinese border. He was teaching his pupil cricket. He got his cricket equipment out there. For heaven's sake.
Cricket in cricket comes to Siberia. An odd image.
And there was a woman who did incredible work. She went out to see if she could find a cure for the victims of leprosy in a remote part of Siberia. And she'd never been on a horse before, but she rode thousands of miles, actually with pain from an internal abscess, and with a wooden saddle, too. And she did astounding work and put up the first... Finally, she raised money by lecturing in Russia, America, and Britain. I don't know where she came to in the States. And raised enough money to build a leprosy hospital in the wilds of Yakutia. And this was in existence until about the 1940s, curiously enough, when leprosy was finally eradicated there. And they still revere her memory very much there.
What was her name?
Kate Marsden. She wrote a marvelous book called On Sledge and Horseback Among Outcast Siberian Lepers. A resounding title. Marvelous Victorian title. The tragedy was that some people didn't believe her story when she came back.
It seemed
to
too
Britain.
Fantastic.
Oh, that's right. And she got an introduction. She got a letter of introduction from Florence Nightingale, from Queen Victoria, and from the Empress of Russia. And she only had about 6 words of Russian at her disposal to start with. But she was obviously a great intrepid type. She felt she'd got a vocation, she'd been called by God to do this work, and, you know, nothing was going to stand in her way. But it was just so sad that, you know, she wasn't acknowledged by some people anyhow, although she was one of the first fellows, women fellows, of the Royal Geographical Society, which previously hadn't accepted them. But, you know, that's an amazing story. But there are amusing ones also. I mean, there was a man who went out with a travelling circus, for instance, and he, curious enough, as they went east, he was a Cockney, and, curious enough, also an albino. And as this travelling circus went east across Siberia in sort of the 1860s, roughly, as far as I remember, I would have thought there'd be more and more interest, but there seemed to be less and less. The circus did worse and worse. He finally parted from it and ended up starting the first billiard saloon in Siberia. And I think that was Krasnoyarsk, as far as I remember. He also imported French wines, but he got a great gift for language, and so he was used as an interpreter for all sorts of different, I suppose, European languages that he picked up on his travels with the travelling circus.
What eclectic and diverse
interests. Well, these are just some of the people. I mean, across the board, it's just amazing. And also exports of Siberian butter, which came out in but massive quantities to Britain before the revolution.
Why would that be a particularly good butter producing area?
Because the southwest of Siberia is extremely fertile. They had very good, lush grazing lands for the cattle. There was, curious enough, this is a British angle on this too, in that there was a British woman, an English woman, married to a Siberian farmer, and she started the first butter production of a certain sort. I don't quite understand about Siberian butter, but they were producing butter of some sort, but not the sort that's used in Europe. And so she set this up. It ultimately became a model farm, and there was a great deal of cooperative dairy farming, which was built up, and butter was coming out in by the train load through to the Baltic ports. It was on ice-refrigerated freight cars. Uh-huh. And it was shipped through to Denmark, where much of it was passed off as Danish butter, I may say. I won't be sued for slander for saying that, but I think that's historically accurate. And through to London, and in such not only London, but other ports, and in such large quantities that it cut the price of butter overall in Britain. And the urban proletariat was, you know, always eating Siberian butter, which I think was marketed as under the name of Mayflower butter. And in fact, Lenin found that he was eating Siberian butter in London himself when he was there in exile.
How extraordinary.
Mm. Well, this is one of just the many, many, many extraordinary
because
remarkable stories.
The transportation, you simply would think that the transportation would be such an overwhelming obstacle to really competing.
Well, that's right.
On a free market.
Yeah, that's right.
I think even in Alaska, we think of Siberia as a very isolated place. Even though we are, in fact, close proximity. And certainly products going from Siberia to Europe or to the continent seems like a real complex thing, especially in the 19th century.
Well, this is the early 20th century, actually, that the butter story happened. But, of course, it was really quite simple in that all it had got to do was to get onto the Trans-Siberian Railway and run to to Petersburg and beyond to the Baltic ports. And off it came by ship. So it was just a sort of two-leg run once it had got to the railhead.
When was the Trans-Siberian Railway built?
This was at the tail end of the 19th century.
And that was used more common? I mean, was it in better shape? Was it used more then? Do you think there was more back and forth then than there is now?
No, I'm quite sure not. Because I was quite amazed. I'd imagined in my innocence and ignorance that, one would see a passenger car a passenger train every 6 hours or something on the railway or something like that, and it would be in the occasional goods train, or do you call it freight train? But when I stood by the side of that railway, here were not so many passenger trains, although certainly more than I'd anticipated. They might have passed by perhaps every, say, half hour or something, perhaps not as much as that, but the freight trains and very long trains were passing by, I should think, every sort of 6 minutes. Mm-hmm. And they were long trains. So I was amazed at the enormous amount of carriage on that railway. Extremely active. And all moving fairly slowly, much more slowly than one would say have in British trains. I don't know how fast your Anchorage Fairbanks train is. But
it's not fast.
No.
Well, and in additionally, in the winter, we have had, especially last year because of heavy snows, a lot of problems with moose on the yeah. line, and we've had a lot of moose kills on that railroad area because, of course, they clear the snow there, and so it's a good browsing area for moose. And as a result, the trains need to go very slowly to try and keep those railroad kills to
yes.
a minimum, and so
right.
I think that's even slowed it down. But we have recently taken over the railroad from the federal auspices, and the state has taken it over, and it's problematic to try and make it a paying proposition and to make it viable. That sounds very in very marked contrast to Siberia.
Well, I tend to think it's not so much the moose or the wildlife which slows the trains down there. I suspect it's because it's running through a huge area of permafrost or discontinuous permafrost. And so the trains are running slowly for safety's sake on those grounds.
A book I read a few years ago, something Railway Bazaar by that author.
Paul Theroux.
Oh, Paul yeah. Theroux. That's yeah. right. I'm glad I was sort of sorting through my mind trying to think of who he was. And I remember reading his experience on the Trans-Siberian Railway and talking about it being quite an uncomfortable trip. Cars either very overheated or underheated, and a lot of drinking of vodka and just general public drunkenness on the train. He didn't make it sound very enjoyable. At least I didn't want to set out and make that my next. Have you ridden on that train?
Yes, but I've never done the whole thing. I've done sections of it, and I found it really very interesting. Of course, as an experience, I think I might get a little bored if I did the whole journey. But I think if anybody's tempted to do it, the most interesting section is around the south shore of Lake Baikal, where they've cut through the tunnels, and hopefully one is going to do that ride in the daytime rather than at night. So one does have these flashes when one comes out of the tunnels of this tremendous lake down below one, stretching off into the distance. And then there are the mountains to the east of the lake, which it's good to get through westwards. It's basically all flat, except going through the foothills of the Urals, which aren't very, very, very dramatic.
Did that strike them at the time as a great technological accomplishment?
Very much so. They couldn't get through the mountains at the bottom of the lake to start with. So they had to, there's another British-Siberian story, they had to transport the passengers from one side of the lake where the railway stopped across the lake to the other side, and then they resume their journey, because drilling through the mountains and the southern edge of the lake at that time was too difficult a feat. So those, can I go back again to this?
Sure.
Because it is rather an interesting and intriguing story. So what happened was they commissioned from Newcastle on Tyne two icebreakers. Well, first of all, there was one icebreaker, which was the largest icebreaker ever built at that time. This was in the 1890s. It was called, inevitably perhaps, the Baikal. They put it up, they built the thing on the Tyne, and then took it all to pieces again with every piece numbered. They painted all the port parts black and the starboard sides white, or vice versa, I forget now. This was then put on the boat or on successive ships to Petersburg, and these pieces were taken overland to as far as the Trans-Siberian at that time went. Then they were put on sledges, and, it was part sledge, part barge. They finally found their way to lakeside at Baikal, where I think most of them were dumped in the mud and half of them were lost in the inimitable Russian style, bless their hearts. And then the thing went up there with, I think, two Scottish engineers in charge, and it took about 3 years to rebuild it, then went into service on the lake. And it was carrying a complete Trans-Siberian railway on board, a train,
mm-hmm.
Also several hundred passengers.
So it was ferrying the train
that's right.
across
and
across
ice-breaking
the lake.
Too.
And ice-breaking at the same
yeah,
time.
Yeah, and there was even an Orthodox chapel on board.
What a bizarre picture that conjures
quite
up in my mind. How big is that lake?
As far as I remember, it's about 300 miles long from north to south.
An immense lake.
Oh, it is, and immensely deep too. It's by far the deepest lake on Earth. It's nearly getting on for a mile deep, which is a tremendous depth, and therefore the conjunction of surface area is a sort of crescent-shaped lake. Surface area and depth amasses the largest amount of fresh water anywhere in the world. It's 1/5 of the world's freshwater reserves.
Really?
Mm. It's an astounding lake. And it's also by far the oldest lake on Earth, something like 20 to 25 million years old. I think scientists don't dispute this. You know, it's somewhere between the two. And so there's something like 1,500 species which have developed in that immense period of time in that lake, which aren't found anywhere else in the world.
Fish
and sponges and crustaceans and the freshwater seal of Baikal, of which there are something like 50,000 to 60,000, and so on and so on and so on.
How extraordinary! It is. Another sort of Galapagos Island complex,
right.
But right. in a different way,
that's
in a different
right.
respect.
Yes.
Was Darwin aware of that area?
What an interesting thought. Not as far as I know. I must go and look up my Darwin to see. But what an very intriguing thought that is.
I'm visiting with John Massey Stewart, who's a writer and a journalist with some very special interests in Siberia. When was the first time that you actually went to Siberia yourself?
That was in 1961, which is what now, 20-something years ago, 24 years ago. And that was as part of a long trip across the Soviet Union. This was the first year that one could get to the Pacific coast. So I saw this as a very interesting sort of journalistic thing to do and wrote this up. What this led to was that while writing my chapter on Siberia for a book that I did, I then realized I hadn't got quite enough gutsy matter to make this a strong chapter. So I started reading up the history, and I thought, my goodness, you know, this isn't just a question of exiles and convicts and salt mines, although actually the salt mine story, I think, is a total and utter myth. I don't think there was a single salt mine ever in Siberia.
Really?
No.
Where did it come from?
I don't know. I don't quite understand this. Certainly there were salt, I'm not quite sure what you call them, salt pits, I suppose. What happened was that you had shafts which were drilled down from the upsurface by, I suppose, relatively crude or relatively sophisticated equipment, and these were then flooded, and you then drained up the drine, or rather you pumped up the brine,
uh-huh.
and then you evaporated off the water, and that is where you got your salt. And all right, so there were political prisoners in the Tsarist time who were pushed down into the mines to mine lead and gold and so on and silver underground, but I've never seen any accounts ever of any salt mines in Siberia. And why this myth grew up, I've never been able to establish.
Maybe a question of some mistranslation of some...
Well, I don't know. I think people may have put two and two together. I think there were salt mines. I mean, I've been in salt mines in Austria. I think there were salt mines in Poland. Poland was part of the Russian Empire until the revolution. There were Polish political prisoners who were sent by the score, by the tens of thousands virtually, to Siberia. And maybe the whole thing somehow got put together.
Mm-hmm. A sort of collection of half-truths.
Well,
I was amazed doing some reading earlier on this fall to discover how lengthy the Siberian history of exiling political undesirables and basically social undesirables to that area has been, dating from the Mongolian occupation. That astounded me.
Oh, it goes back an enormously long time. You know what the first exile was, don't you? Did
no.
you come across that?
No.
The first exile was a bell, curious enough. There was an insurrection, as far as I remember, a place called Uglich, in not so far from Moscow. It was an abortive insurrection at the time of Ivan the Terrible. And it was the bell which tolled the signal for this uprising. And the thing was put down. And the Tsar gave orders for the bell to be exiled to Siberia.
The bell itself.
Which gave the signal for this. I mean, extraordinary sort of medieval outlook, I think. Okay. Incredible concept. And so the bell had its, what do you call it, clapper, isn't that what it's called?
Mm-hmm.
Cut off, you know, as its tongue cut out, disgusting thought, and sent off to Siberia. And there it stayed for some hundreds of years.
Actually, it's too bad that we don't have that as a precedent, that, you know, if you have a war and there's a problem that you damage the opponent's guns or damage the opponent's cannons rather than the opponent's.
That's a very sensible idea.
You know, the bell gets banished as if the symbol, the banishment of the symbol would be the banishment of the idea.
Yeah, why don't you pass it on to the Pentagon and the Kremlin?
That's right. Let's propose it. There's precedent. They should good precedent that should be followed. You imagine Siberia is this great homeland for all this arsenal.
Right.
Freezing. We've lost some tracks here. Okay, I want to go back to that start of that story that I sort of got you off track of, where the icebreaker was providing the transportation for the train. You were talking about the British-Russian cooperation at the time of the building of the Siberian Railway. Did I get you off that topic prematurely?
One could go on. I think actually it's quite interesting what happened to that icebreaker, in that during the Civil War in Siberia, it had never actually proved a great success. The ice had been too thick for it to really be able to break properly.
This is, of course, a very early icebreaker. We're talking about the one that was at the end of the 19th century, 1890s.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I think it started probably in service on the lake about 1900, okay. by the time it was complete. It was never a huge success. This was followed by a passenger icebreaker, come ferry to take people across the lake. And then when they constructed the tunnels around the southern side of the lake, then these icebreakers were superseded, right?
Mm-hmm.
Although the larger one, the Baikal, this, I think it continued in service during the summer, probably, along the lake. During the Civil War, what happened to it was it was blown up by the Czech Legion, which was trying to make its retreat eastwards and get out of Vladivostok. That's another interesting story, one of many. It was blown up, and it was later used in its shattered state or semi-shattered state as a prison camp for captured Austrian and German prisoners who were seen by the British troops there, and they wrote about this. And then it is now finally under the surface of the lake, and apparently on a particularly clear day when the water isn't ruffled, and because of the remarkable clarity of the lake, one can still see the tops of the funnels.
Huh.
But the other one, the smaller one, the passenger ship, that still can be seen. That served on the lake until about the 1960s, I think. So that was a long spell of time.
Was that still serving when you made your first trip there?
It wasn't still serving. It had just been put out to graze. It had been put at one side of a creek, looking, I'm afraid, a little dilapidated. And there have been plans to restore it and turn it, first of all, into a restaurant and then a museum. But it's become more and more dilapidated, I'm afraid. And occasionally one sees some critical letters in the Soviet press saying, what is happening about this historic ship? Because, in fact, there was a massacre on board it of some Bolshevik hostages by the whites, which is a rather bloody and nasty episode. So it's, you know, part of the Siberian mythology. But I would be delighted if they restored it, because it's had such an extraordinary history.
That's a really wonderful idea, passenger icebreaker. How did you find Siberia on your first trip? What did it confirm your anticipated thoughts about it, or was it very different? Can you recall?
I'm not quite sure that I remember exactly what I thought I was going to find. I'll tell you what I think was my striking impression on that time. At that time, that was that I had expected, going into the heartland of this vast Mother Russia, that one would find the whole place was really much more, if you like, this was the early days of foreigners there, was much more suspicious, was much less easy to move about in. You know, there was much more bureaucracy and so on. And this was on the contrary. I found just the contrary to be the case. I found people were much more friendly, and it was miles away from the capital, and so to a certain extent there was relative freedom, and I think people on the whole were rather pleased to be away, quite so far away from the capital.
So a different kind of atmosphere than exists in the Russian capitals.
I think that would be right, yes.
Although it is a place of exile, then there's not so much scrutiny.
Well, I mean, the terrible era of that exile system is, and the political camps, thank heavens, is over. Okay, so they've still got a system there now, but I mean, it can't compare to what it was what it was before, and I think most of the people are certainly, you know, criminal residents, if you like, of the camps.
I recently saw a movie called White Nights, which has been receiving a lot of publicity. Have you seen it? It's with Gregory Hines and Mikhail Baryshnikov.
And, I'm afraid I haven't.
Baryshnikov is a previously defected Russian dancer, as he is in real life, and his plane crashes, and he's stuck again in Russia. And there's a fabulous scene where Gregory Hines, who has in fact gone and become a Russian citizen because he's protesting American discrimination of blacks, is a member of a small theater company in this remote Siberian village, and he is doing Porgy and Bess with this little Russian orchestra, and there's some wonderful scenes of the town, and I think actually it was filmed in Finland, so I have absolutely no idea how accurate it is, but it just seems so anomalous to have this wonderful black tap dancer doing Porgy and Bess in this remote Siberian village.
Yes, I must try to get to see that.
Uh-huh. There are lots of scenes, and of course, I assume the terrain in Finland is quite similar to that in Siberia.
Well, it's in some parts, yeah.
So I have no idea how accurate it would be. But one got a sense of extreme isolation and of real provincialism. Do the towns strike you as very sort of backwoods, cut off from sort of mainstream technology? It seemed very old-fashioned, like one might imagine a sort of 1940s.
Well, I think, as usual, there's an extraordinary sort of disparity in what one finds in the Soviet Union. One finds, you know, remarkable, if you like, symbols of progress or technology, and remarkable symbols of whatever the antonym is of that, you know, backwardness, if you like. They seem to go hand in hand. And here one does find innumerable Siberian villages looking perhaps very much as they did in the 1900s or 1890s, other than the telegraph wires overhead, but, you know, log cabins and the smoke curling up from them, and fences and chickens and cattle and so on, and unpaved roads and unpaved streets. But at the same time, you've got places like Akhadym Gorodok, the great scientific city, which was built in a particularly attractive part of West Siberia, with top rank, I mean, world scientists and amazing scientific equipment. Not always, but in many cases, doing work way ahead of in some cases, what people are doing in the West, and on a very big scale indeed. And that's just one of these big scientific, it's the biggest, but there are several other scientific centers in Siberia and the Soviet Far East doing a lot of very interesting work.
Are they doing work particular to northern climate research? I mean, is their location just coincidental, or are they particularly geared toward Arctic research? Or
I think, well, Arctic research certainly, but basically they're there, I think, to plan, to research and plan the development of Siberia, because it is so stiff, full of mineral resources and natural resources of one sort or another. So that is the basic, that's the ultimate application. But, I mean, there are places in the Arctic, on the Taimyr Peninsula, for instance, which are working, scientific institutes, which are working on agriculture up there. And here in Fairbanks, you've had a lot of dealings with the big scientific research institute in Magadan on the Soviet Far East Coast. This scientific thing is just one symbol of what is happening there, but certainly there are universities and so on and so forth.
Siberia has been, in fact, a source of great mineral riches for the Soviet Union, and at one point I remember seeing pictures of trains, and I have no idea where, somewhere in Siberia, pulled into a station with great supplies of mammoth tusks, like 10 feet tall and looking seemingly to sort of stretch indefinitely out along the track, and I know that they were one of the greatest suppliers of ivory at one point to the ivory market earlier on in the century at some point.
Yeah, I'm actually quite riveted to hear you say that. And if you can tell me where you saw that photograph, I'd dearly like to get hold of it. I've never seen that. And that'll be very useful for me in the book that I'm doing at the moment, which is on the natural history of Siberia.
Okay, we'll find that for you afterwards.
Indeed, I go down on my bended knee. It'd be marvelous to put that in.
So they're continuing to develop those resources. I mean, I understand.
And how? And there's, I mean, you name it, they've got it, basically. And there's been enormous development of oil and natural gas in the western Siberia over the past 10, 15 years. And now the natural gas is coming through to a lot of countries of Eastern and European and Western Europe by pipeline. And, you know, something like 10 years ago, as I understood it, Vienna was being lit on Siberian natural gas.
Really?
Mm.
And how do they get it out?
Oh, by pipeline.
By pipeline. Yeah. They've got a pipeline that goes from Siberia to Austria.
That's right. Actually, to be quite precise, it's very difficult to establish what is Siberian, what is Western Europe, what is European Russian gas coming through. But certainly there's going to be some, you know, you can't differentiate, obviously.
Where does that pipeline go from to?
It comes from Western Siberia, and it runs through, I think it's through the Ukraine and into Austria and Italy, and now is coming west. I think it's, I may be wrong here, I hope nobody's going to jump on me for it, but I think it's now coming through to France as well, as far west as that.
And do they have an accompanying oil pipeline, or is it simply natural gas?
It's gas.
And no oil pipeline. So we've done the reverse. We have an oil pipeline that comes down, and lots of talk about developing a natural gas line because of the byproduct gas that occurs from the drilling operations up north, but we haven't decided whether that's economically feasible. Sounds like we have really a lot of things in common, but is it your impression that the communication or sharing of this technological information is somewhat difficult between, say, Alaska and in Siberia?
Well, I'm sure that as far as some Soviet technology is concerned, you know, that they don't want to know about sharing it. And similarly, I suppose vice versa can well be the case. But why I'm particularly pleased to be here in Fairbanks is that I'm quite sure that there's more research going on Siberia within the life sciences than there is anywhere else. Sorry, that's rather ungrammatically put. But I think there's more going on here than anywhere else outside the Soviet Union. So I've done two lectures here now, and I've done another lecture in Juneau, and I'm going to do one in Anchorage. But here in Fairbanks, I'm very pleased to be meeting and talking to these many scientists who've been over on exchange visits and done very interesting things in the field. And, all right, so there is a very active USSR Environmental Exchange Program, and there's also a very active Canadian counterpart. But I think there are more people going from here than from anywhere else, you know, on the North American continent.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems a natural association. And, of course,
right.
Alaska had a whole Russian period when this area was Russian.
That's right. And I find that an extraordinarily interesting story, actually. And the Alaska tourist authorities very kindly paid for me to go to Sitka to look at that story, and I'm very grateful to them. And I find it really most interesting, the whole story of the Russian penetration into Alaska, I think is quite fascinating. And I must say, I was very concerned in Sitka to find that people seemed, I mean, this is all right on the basis of only two or three people that I talked to, but they don't seem to be conscious of hanging on to the artifacts and historical documents of Russian America that they should. I mean, this is their heritage, and they don't realize how important these are historically. And there was one man who told me that he'd bought this particular house, which was of Russian construction, and that it had been used for various official purposes, and that it was full of cubby holes, which were like rat's nests, he said, and that he went through the stuff in them and poking about with a stick, and official-looking documents he just put on one side and kept, but the rest he just chucked out, which I think is terrible.
Which is
terrible.
A precious social history.
Well, absolutely. And I met also somebody else who said that she had found various things in her possession. And all right, so she'd sold them to somebody, I'm not sure who, but hadn't realized the value of them. She does now, but she rather regretted it. So I do hope Alaskans are going to wake up. I mean, forgive me saying this, because, you know, I'm an outsider, but it seems terrible to be throwing away things which they can piece the history together with. Once they're gone, they're gone.
Well, I think that you, in that story, implied what the problem is, that people don't have an appreciation for how rare this may be. I've had as a recent guest on my program Richard Pierce, and he is actually one of the world's most renowned experts in the history of the Russian-American period. And it struck me how little documentation there is, and how little has been translated, and how little is really accessible to historians. It's a real small amount of information.
Well, absolutely. He's actually very kindly put me up while I've been in Fairbanks. But he says, he told me that there's a great deal of documentation in Washington where it's ended up. But nonetheless, I don't think I'm misquoting him in saying that I think he's rather concerned that there's not as enough interest as there should be in Sitka, which after all was the capital of Russian America. That these sort of documents and artifacts may go. I mean, he pointed out that it was the Indian material, the Indian artifacts, which people were interested in, and the Russians were interested in themselves and sent back to Petersburg in massive quantities. But that because the Russian artifacts were in everyday use, it was thought nothing of. You know, it was a kettle, it was a, you know, a chair or what have you, and so it was used. And once it was used up, out it went.
Mm-hmm. Well, so much of, I guess that's what gives things value subsequently, is that so many of us have had access to things, thrown them out, not believing
right.
or thinking that they would ever be of particular value. And
right.
those people who did save them,
yeah.
of course, profit.
But I find it very, very intriguing, actually, that so much money has been put into the rebuilding of the Orthodox Cathedral there, and they've done a beautiful job, and also an immense fortune into the restoration of the bishop's house. And again, they're doing marvelous things, and I was tremendously impressed. And yet people don't seem to be aware of this question of retaining what may still be around before it's too late.
Of course, the religious life is part of their current life, and so the religious history has some special emotional and spiritual meaning for them now today. And I think Alaskans in general may be forgiven. And, of course, to be in the interior is a different experience than to be in the area that actually was settled by many of the Russian American Company, by many members of the company, which is along the coast in the Sitka area. But it creates an odd history for us, given the sort of background of our present animosity and post-World War II animosity toward the Russians in general, to think that we actually have a history which is as long Russian as it is American. I mean, right now we are sort of at the equal point, 150 years of Russian occupation, and you know, so.
Yes.
But I think it puts people in a dilemma to sort of think about it in that context, and that may be some of the disinclination. Once the possession of Alaska switched to America, our eyes really just turned around from looking east. We of course now, we look east now. We did look west. I'm getting confused here. Where we are. All right, you took your first trip in 1961.
Sorry, could I just go back to something?
Sure.
Another thing that I'm very intrigued about is on this Russian-American score. I got very interested doing a chapter for the book that I'm working on. I got very interested in the voyage of Bering to Alaska shores. And on board his ship was Stella, Georg Wilhelm Stella, or Stella, the German naturalist. And this is the whole story of the exploration and discovery of Siberia's natural history. I've been lecturing on last night here, and I will be in Anchorage too. But he was the first naturalist. All right, so it was only an offshore island, the Kayak Island, that he was working on. But again, that voyage and what led up to the voyage seems to be rather astonishingly little known in Alaska, as far as I can understand. I may be wrong, but this is my understanding. And I find that strange that people aren't aware of really what triggered off the Russian penetration
into like
Alaska.
We have a whole audience out there now. Would you like to share a little bit of this so that we are a little more knowledgeable about it?
Well, I mean, maybe people know far more than I'll ever know about it, but this isn't my impression. I mean, I don't, you know, okay, so I've done a bit of research into it, but I haven't been, I have been into one or two of the original archives. But, I mean, it was as a result of that sea voyage by Bering, and by the way, I'm delighted to find that there's not only the Bering Sea, which is named after him, and it was Cook who decided on that nomenclature, but there is a Bering Glacier, and there's also a Stella Glacier, and of course there's Stella's Jay and Stella's Sea Lion and Stella's Sea Cow and all these other things, so at least he's not forgotten in that context. But it was as a result of that ship going back. The orders were from St. Petersburg to find the American coast, and they found it, and the ship then, to very much oversimplify the story, the ship then got hit by storms and scurvy and so on, and they were shipwrecked on Bering Island, what is now Bering Island, one of the Commander Islands east of Kamchatka. And it was there that they found the sea mammals, including Stella's sea cow, but also the sea otter. And when they finally rebuilt their ship, which was in a pretty totally dilapidated condition indeed, and got back to Kamchatka with about 600 or 900 sea otter skins, it was those pelts which people realized, my goodness, there's a fortune to be made here. And thus began the fur rush across the Aleutian Islands and into Alaska. And it was this which, as I understand it, caused Russian America to come into being and the whole history of Alaska to move forward from that point on. I mean, maybe this is totally understood by all Alaskans, in which case, you know, I apologize.
Well, no, I don't think it is, and I don't think we many of us are newcomers to the state. That describes more of us than those of us who were born here and educated in Alaska, and I think many of us, in fact, do not have the history of the state because we weren't educated in the state. I mean, all school children have some local history that they're given in some way, and the fact that we have so many newcomers probably deprives us of at least more formal understanding of the state's history. Was there some motivation to find the Northwest Passage in some of this exploration?
Certainly. What happened originally was that Peter the Great, in his last few months of life, he was a dying man, he'd wanted for a long time to establish the truth about whether there really were straits at the north, or rather at the eastern point of his empire, or whether Russia was joined by land to America or not. So he sent off Vitus Bering, who was a Danish captain in Russian service, who'd served Russia for a long time, to investigate. And this was a five-year-long voyage. This was known as the first Kamchatka expedition. And Bering did sail up and built his ships on the Sea of Ohotsk and then crossed to Kamchatka, built more ships there and sailed up and believed that he had found that there were straits because he'd gone further north and there was no more land, it was just sea. So he came back to Petersburg and said, yes, I think I've proved it. History slightly diverges onto what the policy was then or what the reaction then was in Petersburg. Some people say that the authorities didn't believe him, and so he, in fact, curiously enough, masochist, volunteered to do the thing over again. Other people, however, say that this was a sort of cover-up. They didn't want the Europeans to know what was happening. So what he was sent back, and what, however, these historians say he was asked to do then was to find this sea voyage, the shortest route to America, and see if he could find European settlements on the American coast. So this was a tremendous undertaking. It was actually a 10-year-long expedition, and there were some 5,000 people on the payroll across that time. So, you know, 10 years and 5,000 men in the 18th century across that tremendous area of land and then across totally uncharted seas was a really stupendous undertaking. And it wasn't only just to find America. They also wanted to find Japan. They did find the Japanese islands. They wanted to chart the entire northern coastline of Russia, other than a little section north of Moscow or Petersburg, and they succeeded basically in that with a great loss of life. And they also wanted to look at the interior, and there was a very interesting scientific expedition which coped with that. And so Stella was one of the scientists of this expedition. It was he who sailed finally with Bering. But again, this is a story which I find is remarkably unknown. When I've given lectures in Britain and other places, I've said to me, this must be the largest largest expedition of exploration, surely up until the Second World War or something. And I've talked to geographers and said, you know, please shoot me down if I'm wrong. And people seem to confirm this is right. And indeed, they say probably, but ever, because okay, there've been international expeditions of one sort or another, or on a larger scale. But they haven't been exploring expeditions, so I think this is the biggest ever. So, heading for the Guinness Book of Records.
And
if I may interrupt, and I think, again, unknown in the outside world, I've actually done a three-quarter-hour radio program for the BBC on this, for the 250th anniversary of it, because there are participants' own narratives, and very graphic they are too, I was able to use those with just a linking thread and actors and sound effects. And I think it went off, although, I'm seeing myself quite well. And it was then, this radio, of course, it was then put on the World Service, and it was also translated into Russian.
Oh, I'd love to hear that.
Russian, so I've got a copy here.
Oh, good. You did this for the BBC in England.
Yeah. But interestingly enough, you see, although one would have thought that any country which had done a thing on this scale in the 18th century, and it was successful, would be enormously proud of it, it doesn't feature a great deal, even in sort of Soviet school textbooks, much to my astonishment. I would be so proud, I think, if it was my country that had done that. I mean, all right, so it's past history. So one would be pleased to think, a very impressive thing, looking backwards in one's own history. And I can't really understand why they don't make more song and dance about it. I think the only thing I can think is that they give far more attention to Soviet explorers of Soviet time. They rather downgrade what happened in the 18th century.
The Tsarist period.
Well, right. And also, I think maybe they're a little disappointed that the leader of the expedition, Bering, wasn't a Russian. I think then, he was a foreigner. I think then, if he had been Russian, maybe he would be, a big Russian hero.
Mm-hmm. Because we do in our history, Lewis and Clark explored river systems, and it's quite a prominent story for American school children.
Absolutely.
About the study. And this is something that is far more enormous in scope and undertaking.
Yes.
It's not very common, I guess, for leaders and for governments to undertake exploration that is purely and simply for scientific information purposes, and I suppose that's...
Well, I don't think, of course, that was purely for scientific purposes, really. I think they were ultimately thinking of colonizing America, or what could be colonized, and of trade.
And they did, of course, eventually go down to the California coast and...
That's right, yeah.
And even, I understand, made a landing on Hawaii. I think if I'd been Siberian, I would have wanted to stay there, but apparently not. Maybe it just seems so in the winter.
Yes, well, it would be very interesting, wouldn't it, historically, if Hawaii had turned out to be a Russian colony.
One can hardly imagine it. I guess just because of our images of Russia, it just seems so discordant. But
right. Yeah.
If it had been, we might have a different idea of Russians and things Russian. I do not want, my curiosity has been piqued, and so I don't want to finish here without circling back. For those of you who tuned in late, I am speaking with John Massey Stewart, who is an English journalist and writer who has a very special interest in Siberia. Your first trip was in 1961. You went to get some color and to sort of flesh out a chapter.
It was part of a trip, which was then written up in book form. And
That was the first time that you were allowed to go clear across
to
the coast.
That's right.
And so you covered that for a paper you were working for at the time.
Well, no, because I've been freelance basically.
Uh-huh.
But that turned into a fairly lengthy book, but since then I've been back really quite a lot of times. and have seen a certain amount, although I'm afraid they don't let one into all the places one would like to see by any means.
Do you get special privilege because you have been there and because obviously
no,
you're such a...
Absolutely not.
...a fan of Siberia? What about that first trip really sparked you to make some kind of special career interest in
well,
that area?
Well, what happened, as I think I was starting to say, but we've got to deflect on to other matters.
We tend to sort of gather,
right.
roam around the field yeah. here.
I think what happened was that I started by reading up the Siberian history to realize how interesting that was. I thought, my goodness, you know, I'd like to write that up. And then from there, I jumped to Siberian present day and the culture and the native peoples. And they are extraordinarily interesting because they have such very diverse cultural and religious and ethnic backgrounds and different languages and so on.
They have as many or more groups as we in Alaska have.
Oh, I think far more. Most interesting. And everything I turned to seemed to be of interest and relatively unknown to people in the West. And when I looked at the natural history and the whole sort of environmental thing, again, I found what extraordinarily interesting things there were there to be said and generally not understood or appreciated or known about. And so that's what I've been working on now for rather longer than I care to confess. And I just, the deeper one goes into any one subject, and I'm afraid I'm trying to cover perhaps far too many subjects, the more interesting one finds it, and the more one finds that it isn't really generally known.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ranging from, if you like, the active volcanoes of Kamchatka to, all right, so there are lots of people working on permafrost here, but the largest wetlands on Earth, which are in the West Siberian Plain, the many endangered species of, and rare species of flora and fauna, you know, the Siberian tiger in the south of the Soviet Far East, and the Amur leopard, and Siberian white crane. And I may say I've been thrilled. One of the things I've done on this trip was to home in on Baraboo, Wisconsin, where there's an interesting ornithologist, George Archibald, who does marvelous work on the world's rare cranes. And what he's done is set up an agreement with the Russians under the USSR Environmental Protection Agreement to get eggs flown out from the Siberian tundra of the Siberian white crane to Baraboo, Wisconsin. And there they're hatched out by foster common cranes. And the idea is then to build up a stock there so that eggs can then be flown back into Russia and hatched out to form a wild population of the Siberian white crane.
Are they endangered?
Yes, they most certainly are. It was thought there were only about 200 to 250 of them left. But then just in recent years, to everybody's stupefaction, the Chinese found something like 1,000 of them. So what is interesting here, you see, and this is one of the many interesting things, one keeps on finding these new discoveries about what is, to me, a continent-sized area. It is bigger than other continents, actually. So the interesting thing that here, is, of course, is where they're coming from. I mean, there's some part of Siberia which they're breeding in, which people don't yet know about.
Because the population density is so small.
Well, because of this new number which has been found in China, where are these things coming from? Nobody knows yet. So here's a nice little task for the ornithologists to track them down.
To really make some history.
Right.
In the field,
right.
One gets the sense after a while that all the discoveries have been made.
I think by no means.
And by no means
by
is
no
that
means.
True. And Siberia, and I think Alaska also proved that point very well, that there's lots to be still discovered and still found out. We've just got to go to slightly more adverse climates to break new ground, if you will.
Yes.
And so you have a special interest in the natural history of Siberia.
That's right.
And have been doing work on that. It's really tantalizing. We have stories a little bit about that great meteor fall. And I think there have been different theories, but there's been some coverage in the national press about what exactly occurred there. What is the latest theory on that?
I'm not sure that there's exactly a latest theory, but I think the Russians believe it was a comet which exploded.
Would you describe it for our audience in case they didn't hear? It's this great...
Well, there was, I think it was 1903. I'm rather bad on my dates always, but I think it was 1903, this tremendous impact, which seems to be actually above the Siberian ground level. And as a result, a vast area of forest was burnt out, but a vast area, and the shock waves went something like 1.5 times around the world. And I've seen these sort of barometric readings in some station in southern England, and you see the graph suddenly shoot up. And it wasn't because of the revolution, the civil war, and various problems. It wasn't for many years, I think, until the 1920s. Curious enough that the first scientists went out to explore this area, because it's incredibly remote, in forest and sort of very desiccated plateau area. And the Russians are still, 70, 80 years later, still doing research on this. And they still haven't quite pinpointed it, exactly what happened. But they do believe that it was a comet which exploded. And when that first scientist went out and took photographs, the trees were still, of course, bearing their scorch marks and lying down, prone on the ground or teetering over in their thousands. And here in Fairbanks, I've asked people about this, and one of the interesting things which somebody suggested was that, I said, do you think that the vegetation there could possibly be different now, 80 years later from the rest of the area? So they said, well, if it depends what time of the year it was, if it was under snow cover, then maybe the trees were all taken out, if you like, but what was under snow cover could have survived, and without the trees as competition could therefore have thrust their way up, and maybe the whole thing is different. But I slightly wonder, because I would have thought if there was such a huge explosion, all that snow would have melted, but fast.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd certainly like to explore that one.
Lots of areas of for questioning and more study and more research. And I think here in Alaska we have some special affinity for that because we share a climate, we share a latitude. And so for us, that information is even more intriguing. And I thank you for spending a considerable amount of your time trying to unearth some of that information about things Siberian. Is there a great English interest in England in Siberia?
No, I wouldn't say so at all. There's a small academic group which is working on the subject in either history or ethnography or economics. And there is a sort of informal grouping, informal, and next spring, in fact, they are putting on a symposium in London, the University of London, on Siberian studies. And 2 years ago, I think this is increasing the interest in Siberia, certainly. And 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, there was in Paris a fairly big, they called it the colloque, a fairly big colloquium with about perhaps 200 people coming in from different parts of the world. Richard Pierce was there. That was very interesting. I think that's the first time that anyone did that. So I think there is increasing interest in academic circles on the subject, but I don't think, certainly wouldn't say everybody in England is interested. But I think it's interesting, though, in that I think the name Siberia is one of perhaps the few place names which does have...
Immediately conjures up
things. And I've, to a certain extent, when I've seen somebody saying, it's like being exiled to Siberia in the newspapers, I've tended to cut this out, and because it's become
an idiom.
That's right. Absolutely. Right. Worldwide idiom.
Right, a worldwide idiom for exile.
And cold.
And here we are in Alaska, and we can certainly appreciate some of those factors.
I may say, I've been terribly disappointed in Alaska. Because I was hoping for my winter experience. I bought my long johns.
Oh, it's warmed up. Stick around.
And here I am in a heat wave. Although I do find it funny, finding what I think is a fairly cold day as far as my London experience is concerned. People say, oh, but it's so hot.
Yes. Well, I'm enjoying these mild temperatures, but if you'd like to stay the rest of the winter, I'm sure we could accommodate you with some real severe cold. It's been a pleasure to speak with you, John Massey Stewart. We could go on for a long time. We've just barely touched your fascinating experiences in life, and I thank you for joining me. I've been your host, Patty Kostelic, for Home Fires Radio Show. Our executive producer is Carla Tanella, and I wish you all a very nice weekend. Hope this warm weather lasts.